Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The population of the island of Puerto Rico is a little over 3 million, and yesterday, 500,000 people gathered in the streets of the capital, San Juan, demanding the immediate resignation of Governor Ricardo Rosselló. Demonstrations were peaceful until police moved in with tear gas and rubber bullets. Meanwhile, things are also moving fast in the Persian Gulf as Britain calls for a naval fleet to protect vital shipping lanes, but also tells the White House that Europe is going its own way with Iran. So this hour on Point, we'll take a look at what's next on two key stories this week, Puerto Rico and a standoff with Iran. And first, to Puerto Rico, have you been following the protests there? Do you have family members who are in the streets protesting against the Puerto Rican government? Do the protests give you hope? And what exactly, beyond the immediate controversy surrounding Ricardo Rosselló, what exactly is bringing hundreds of thousands of people to the street on the island? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And we'll start today first from Miami with Danielle Morcante, chief news writer for Univision News and political columnist for Univision.com. Danielle, welcome.
Thank you, Meghna. It's good to be on the program.
It's great to have you. So first of all, give us a sense about the current state of the protests in Puerto Rico. Do we expect them to continue to grow over the next days?
I think we can expect the protests to continue for a few days. It's very hard to determine how big they will be. They have already been record numbers of people actually demonstrating on San Juan's streets and also in some smaller cities across the island. But it's very hard to say whether the same numbers will be achieved over the next few days. However, the protests will continue, and as we speak, they're going on. They will go on well into the night.
Now, of course, it's not just in the last day or two that the protests have been going on. They've been going on for several days. Why were demonstrators not satisfied when, I believe, late this weekend, the governor, Ricardo Rosselló, said that he would not run for re-election?
Because their fundamental demand is that he resign, that he actually leaves the post and let somebody else take the reins of government. Unless that is done and, he decides to resign, the protests, I think, are going to continue, and it will be very hard to rule Puerto Rico, to govern Puerto Rico.
Okay. So, Danielle, stand by for just a moment because I want to hear from San Juan, Puerto Rico itself. And Antonia Hilton joins us now. She's civil rights correspondent for Vice News Tonight. Antonia, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what's the mood like in Puerto Rico, in San Juan specifically today, after this massive surge of people who've been taking to the streets?
So the mood is a mix. I'd say the overwhelming emotion is actually joy. People are so proud to have seen Puerto Rico come out the way that it did yesterday. I mean, people from all corners in the island made their way over to Plaza Las Americas and walked, hung out, danced, ate food together all day long. And actually, partway through the day, there was this massive rainstorm that lasted for several hours. And I think people thought for a moment, oh, maybe people are going to head home early and this will dampen the big plans that we had for the day. And people stayed through that and danced in the rain and threw a party under an expressway bridge. And I think people are still kind of riding off that energy this morning. Although, of course, late last night, there were some intense clashes. So there are some folks who are feeling a bit down about what happened between protesters and police officers here in San Juan last night. But really the overwhelming emotion is really just a gratefulness and a pride about the way in which Puerto Ricans came out to support each other yesterday.
Now, Antonio, we're going to talk about sort of the underlying concerns that Puerto Ricans have about their government right now. But can you just remind us briefly about the catalyzing event that really brought people out into the streets about these messages that the governor was revealed to have exchanged with some of his top aides and close friends. What was that all about?
Right. So the local Center for Investigative Reporting released almost 900 pages of leaked chat messages between the governor, other government officials, but actually, in fact, some people who were really more associates of the governor and actually not elected officials. And so not only was the content of this chat conversation really offensive to Puerto Ricans, but actually the people who were in the chat having access to that information was offensive to Puerto Ricans. And to give you a taste of what was said, there were homophobic jokes about Ricky Martin. There were sexist jokes about a number of women. There were some threatening comments. There was discussion about the silencing of political opponents. There was a joke that a lot of folks have been talking about made at the expense of folks who died during Hurricane Maria, a joke about sort of feeding dead bodies to the crows here in Puerto Rico. And, you know, this is really the straw breaking the camel's back, because not only have the people in Puerto Rico suffered through a slow disaster recovery and the worst hurricane they've ever seen, but they're also, many of them feel strangled under the austerity measures designed to help, you know, lessen the debt. But many of them feel it's a strangle to working class Puerto Ricans here on the island. And, you know, years and years of corruption, of course. You know, Puerto Rico isn't new to corruption, but this, the chats were like evidence of everything they suspected all along.
Right.
And not just the evidence, but actually callousness, the way in which that the people joked about what they seem to be aware they were doing to Puerto Ricans at large. And so it's just was such a painful thing to see at an already very vulnerable time.
So, Danielle, let me turn back to you here. Do you agree that this, as Antonio was saying, the messages seem to affirm or confirm the suspicions that hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans had about Roselló and his close aides for some time, and that's what catalyzed them to towards these massive demonstrations?
Yes, basically that's been the case. Roselló is probably the governor who won the most unpopular election and with the lowest percentage of votes in Puerto Rico's recent history. He got about 41.6 or 41.7% of the vote. So he hardly had a universal mandate in Puerto Rico. So he had a lot of enemies, just to begin with, and a lot of critics and opponents. So after mishandling so many things, including a lot of the managing of the actual hurricane, and then these twofold scandals, one having to do with corruption in his government by now former members of his government, and at the same time, the chat scandal, I think was just too much for the majority of Puerto Ricans.
So tell us more about the allegations or evidence of the corruption that existed in Roselló's administration before even this past couple of weeks.
So just a few days before the demonstration started, there was an investigation that became public, in which at least six Puerto Ricans were involved in corruption, which consisted basically in diverting about $50 million from U.S. assistance, federal assistance, to private hands. That means businesses and individuals who are well-connected with the government. These individuals were arrested, they have been investigated, and they will probably be charged with very specific crimes. And at least two or three of them were rather influential at some point, and they were appointed by the governor. So it was really a very tough situation coming into the chat scandal.
I see. So, Antonia, what are your thoughts about the sort of the prior corruption that Danielle was talking about?
The prior corruption is, you know, was the buildup here. Mm-hmm. I think what you keep hearing is particularly Julia Kelleher's name, who is the secretary of the Department of Education. And what has made her some of the, like, a secondary villain in this story has been, well, of course, her role in the education department and the fact that Puerto Rico has closed so many public schools. Yesterday, at the major protest down on the highway, I spoke to family after family. I spoke to teachers who came out And it's a common sort of second thread of the story here. The Puerto Ricans feel like their educational system has been completely destabilized, that its public schools have closed and kids have been having to travel farther and farther to get an education and find themselves joining larger and larger classrooms. That, you know, not only is this sort of a painful and destabilizing act, but it's actually making it harder for young Puerto Ricans to learn. And when young Puerto Ricans struggle to learn, they have less social mobility. And so that's something that you hear, the kind of the connection between education, the corruption, and this sort of concern about the class divide and what people like Governor Rosselló represent in the face of all of that. She and the Department of Education have kind of become a secondary, very popular sort of subject of discussion around this, because the schools seem to be so much of actually what has made so many everyday Puerto Ricans who maybe wouldn't have in the past come out to protest day in and day out, actually has them out in the streets and coming out in pretty late into the night. So I would say that Julia Kelleher has actually been sort of a secondary person here who, you know, I haven't heard her name a ton in mainland, in press on the mainland, but certainly her name is coming up every day here in San Juan.
Okay, so Danielle, what do you think about the secondary name about Julia Kelleher?
Well, imagine, she is a person who was like a career employee in Puerto Rico. She had been working for the department for several years before she came over to the mainland, and then she was asked to go back by the governor, and given the high position that she occupied for a while, there were suspicions about her handling of the Department of Education for a long time before she was basically forced to resign, perhaps seeing the kind of nightmare that was about to take place in Puerto Rico. Mm. So the nickname is understandable. It sticks.
Well, Danielle and Antonia, stand by here for just a second. We are, for this first part of the show, talking about protests in Puerto Rico and what the Puerto Rican people want for the future of their island and for their government. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the protests going on in Puerto Rico against the government of Governor Ricardo Rosselló there. A little later in the show, we'll switch gears and talk about Iran. But right now, I'm joined by Daniel Morcate. He's chief news writer for Univision News and political columnist for Univision.com. Joins us from Miami. Antonia Hilton joins us from San Juan, Puerto Rico. She's civil rights correspondent for Vice News Tonight. And let's listen to the voice of San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulin Cruz. She recently spoke with NBC New York last week about the protests going on in Puerto Rico and what they might mean for the future of the island.
What is happening is that people are tired of corruption. They're tired of self-aggrandizement. They're tired of a government that doesn't reflect the people of Puerto Rico. 600,000 people voted for the governor. 500,000 people asked him to leave. So the message is loud and clear. Democracy is not something that you do once every 4 years. It is something that people in Puerto Rico have awakened to.
That's San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulis Cruz. Now, Governor Rossello himself spoke with Fox News' Shepard Smith yesterday, and Smith pointed out that many people, including Rossello's political allies, have abandoned him. That's what Shepard Smith said. Smith said, quote, "You're a man on an island by himself," and he asked the governor how long he could hold on to power, and here's how Rossello responded.
My effort and my commitment is to follow through on some of the efforts that I've established for the people of Puerto Rico. That includes establishing, again, a plan that I've already circulated with the members within the White House so that we can battle this corruption.
So that's Governor Ricardo Rossello on Fox News yesterday. And just today, we have news here that the governor and 11 others have been served with a search warrant ordering their cell phones to be surrendered as part of an investigation that's being an investigation being done by the islands, the Puerto Rican Island Department of Justice into that Telegram chat scandal we were talking about a couple of minutes ago. So, Antonia Hilton, I know I've got to let you go in a moment, but just let me ask you one last question. How long do you think Rossello can hold on?
You know, I think there are two answers to this. Through Rossello's eyes, he seems to be digging his heels in, and I think his team, the impression here has been that they perhaps have a strategy of thinking that if they just wait and he hides out in his different properties around the island, that eventually people will become exhausted. They'll go back to their jobs. They just won't be able to come out every night anymore, and he'll be able to start a process of some kind of reconciliation. When you talk to regular Puerto Ricans on the ground, they laugh in your face when you say that. They don't see any shot at reconciliation. They are planning to come out as often as they can, with as many pots and pans and new chants as they can come up with. And if they can't make it one night, they're sending friends to go. There's really an informal social network here, people who are sending around flyers that they are quickly drafting up, Excel spreadsheets that I've received. People are trying to keep each other updated. Every morning, texts are going out saying, oh, did you see this on Twitter? Here's the flyer for today. We're dancing in front of La Fortaleza tomorrow night. We're going to do XYZ. Lawyers are going to be in front of the Capitol. Like, already today, there are probably three different solid, firmed up plans for what's going to happen tomorrow. And that has been the culture now for the last 11 days. Uh-huh. And people seem to be getting more and more excited by it, not tired. And so I think if the governor is under the impression that people are going to forget about this at some point soon and are going to trust him to be the person who has to put Puerto Rico back together after it, he may be deluded.
Well, Antonia Hilton, civil rights correspondent for Vice News Tonight, joining us from San Juan, Puerto Rico. Antonia, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Danielle, I'm going to come back to you here in just a second, but I do have a couple of callers who want to give us their thoughts on the situation on the island. So let's go to Javier, first of all, who's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Javier, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
We're fine. Go ahead.
Excellent. So I just wanted to say that for the people listening, this is not just about the chats. This is not just about the bad and mean things that the governor said. This is the straw that broke the camel's back. This has been years and years of mismanagement that have finally come to light. We finally have proof that says that we were right all along, that this has been happening for so long. And we're not going to take no for an answer. He thinks that he can hide. He thinks that he can just wait us out. But that's not the case. I have family members on the island who've been protesting for the past week. They will continue to protest. I myself was out at a protest yesterday, and we will continue to protest until he's gone and the people from his organization are gone. Mm.
Well, Javier, thank you so much for your call. So, Danielle, let me ask you, if Rossello stays on but doesn't run for reelection, or if he resigns before the end of his term, regardless, I'm wondering, it doesn't seem as if that act in and of itself will be enough. Does Puerto Rico need a deeper reform of its political culture here? Because I'm just reminded that Rossello's own father, Pedro, right? He was governor of the island from, what, the mid-90s, 93 to about 2001, also mired in scandal for that entire time.
Yes, his administration was also mired in scandal. Several of his several members of his inner circle ended up in jail after having been tried for corruption. So it is an ongoing situation, and it hasn't been just something that has affected the today's ruling party, which is the Conservative Party, the PNP, but it's also affected just about every important political party in Puerto Rico over the years. So what you have had is a lot of members of the political class who have used patronage in order to win elections, in order to maintain support from the public. And it's actually trickled down to municipalities, the Congress. And a lot of Puerto Ricans are fed up with that, essentially because it is at the center of the major economic crisis that Puerto Rico faces. That kind of attitude by the ruling class for so many years has brought about the huge debt that the Puerto Rican government has incurred, mm-hmm. which surpasses $70 billion. And it's also, you know, the debt itself and the fact that there is an overseeing board trying to make sure that the Puerto Rican government is more austere in the way it uses funds, in practice has meant a lot of pain for the Puerto Rican people. People have lost their pensions. A lot of people have lost their jobs. Thousands of Puerto Ricans over the past 3 or 4 years have had to leave their homes and come to the mainland, to states like New York and Florida. So what we are seeing now is an exhaustion on the part of so many Puerto Ricans with the status quo, which has been a status quo of corruption and of negligence of the actual situation of the Puerto Ricans.
Right. Well, I mean, we heard that clip from Governor Roseo on Fox saying he circulated with members of the White House a plan to battle corruption on the island. But I wonder, how are other elected officials in Puerto Rico looking at this moment? Is there the possibility that Roseo could be pushed out by other branches of the government?
Actually, the consideration of Roseo through an impeachment process, which in Puerto Rico is known as residenciamiento, it's a political trial, is already underway. However, there is suspicion that the process is just too slow, too cumbersome, and that a lot of Puerto Ricans are not willing to wait for the process to take place. So that's why you see all these demonstrators asking Roselló to resign without further ado, just to resign as soon as possible. The other factor here is that the people who essentially would be in charge of trying him, if that ever were to occur, are members of his own party, essentially, because they control the Congress as well in Puerto Rico.
Danielle, so my last question for you then is there a role, or should there be a role, for Washington in aiding or handling the situation on the island?
Well, I think Washington is already playing a major role. As we understand it, there is constant communication between members of Congress, the Roselló government, whatever is left of it, and members of the opposition, leaders in the Puerto Rican legislature, just to make sure that they understand that unless there is a satisfactory outcome in this predicament in Puerto Rico, it will be very hard to justify the sending of assistance to Puerto Rico. And by the way, Puerto Rico has only received $14 billion of $42 billion that have been promised to the island, even though we know that sometimes the White House is in the habit of saying that more than $90 billion have been approved. That's not really the case. But I think that's a mighty pressure that Washington is applying.
Well, Danielle Morcate, joining us from Miami. Danielle is chief news writer for Univision News and political columnist for Univision.com. Danielle, thank you so very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much, Danielle. So that's the situation at the moment on the island of Puerto Rico and the future of the governor there, Governor Ricardo Roselló. But let's now turn to the Persian Gulf region. We'll switch gears here, where the U.S. and Iran have been upping the ante in recent weeks, with drones being shot down, ships commandeered, and where all parties are saying they don't want war, but they cannot seem to find so-called off-ramps that Tehran and Washington need to calm things down. So there are a lot of moving parts to the story in the tension between the United States and Iran. Let's get some help figuring this out from Sanam Vakil. She is head of the Future Dynamics in the Gulf Project and the Iran Forum at the British think tank Chatham House, and she joins us from London. Sanam, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me on, Meghna.
Also joining us from Washington is Laura Rosen, diplomatic correspondent for the Middle East-focused online news site Al Monitor, and you can find links to her reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Laura, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Laura, let me just start with you. First of all, just give us your take on the latest news over the past couple of days from Iran. For example, the Iranian government saying that it has arrested more than a dozen people that it claims were spying on behalf of the United States. What's the significance of that?
Well, we don't know. Trump went out yesterday and denied that the people arrested were spies. Iran frequently calls people American spies who are not. So I have no information on the people who were arrested.
Okay. But is there a significance to Iran making a big announcement about this? Could it be seen as a continuing or further provocation in the eyes or to a provocation of the United States?
I would take it more probably as a signal to their own domestic audience that, you know, they're countering Western pressures on Iran and efforts to what Iranians may see to try to interfere in Iran.
Okay. So Sanam Vakil, just quickly on the alleged spies, what's your thought on that?
I think that the Iranian leadership is indeed trying to play to its domestic audience, as Laura mentioned. They're trying to demonstrate that they're, you know, standing up to this pressure. They're very resilient. And the whole sort of variety of actions we've seen over the past few months are reflective of that pushback strategy that is playing out quite well in Iran.
Okay. Well, so let me then just throw out some questions here to listeners about what they think about the current situation between Iran and the United States. How do you think the White House is handling increasing tensions between Washington and Tehran? And what do you make of the fact that Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia will be meeting with Iran this weekend, but without the U.S. in order to salvage the Iran nuclear deal? Find us online at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook, as always, at onpointradio. Okay, so Sanam, let me get your sense here about, I've seen other analysts, Persian Gulf analysts, saying that they believe Iran is playing what essentially now amounts to a dangerous game here in its continuing provocation of Washington. There's been the fear for many weeks, if not months now, that eventually this could spill over to accidental war. "Quote unquote accidental war." Do you have that concern?
Yes, I very much share that concern. Iran is playing a dangerous game, but the calculation in Tehran is that it is the only game that they can play. They have been sitting in compliance for the past year, from last May to this May, waiting for the remaining signatories of the Iran nuclear agreement, three European countries and Russia and China, to make good on their promises of economic investment in Iran. That hasn't come to fruition. And the calculation inside the country by the leadership has been that actually Iran benefits more through confrontation than it does through conciliation. And this is a reflection of their own understanding of the Trump administration's red lines. They're quite aware that Trump doesn't want to get involved in a military conflict in the region. He didn't shoot down that drone. He wants to draw down from the Middle East. He wants to burden share. This is an America First president. And based on those assessments that they're making, they think that if they increase their own pressure on the Trump administration and Washington's allies in the Persian Gulf, they can raise the temperature and by doing so try and obtain some concessions from the Trump administration as well as from the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese.
I see. So, Laura, let me just get your thoughts on that. What's your response to what Sanam's saying?
I agree with everything. And I think what your listeners may not be aware of was beyond Trump withdrawing from the deal in May 2018, just this last May, a couple months back, they cut off the waivers to eight countries that were buying smaller amounts of Iranian oil, really trying to have no Iranian exports of Iranian oil. And really coinciding with that cutoff of the waivers, you've seen Iran's provocations largely increase with the tankers attacked and, concerns about U.S. Troop security in Iraq and drone shootdowns and other actions. So I think if we could even go back to the April situation, you might have a more status quo that could be sustainable until the U.S. reelection campaign. And in 2020, I do start to wonder if the Trump administration is wondering if they went too far with maximum pressure and don't know quite how to dig out of it. And you see a lot of foreign allies of the United States, like French President Macron in particular, doing shuttle diplomacy, mm-hmm. trying to see if they can find a de-escalation off-ramp.
Well, hang on here for just a moment, Laura and Sanam. We are talking for the rest of this hour about increasing tensions between Washington and Tehran and, yes, how the rest of the international community is responding, particularly our European allies. We'll be right back with more. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, the Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking for the rest of this hour about Iran and Washington and the international community and how tensions seem to continuously be rising in the Persian Gulf. I'm joined today by Sanam Vakil. She's with us from London. She's the head of the Future Dynamics in the Gulf Project and the Iran Forum at the British think tank Chatham House. Laura Rosen also joins us. She's in Washington. She's the diplomatic correspondent for the Middle East-focused online news site Al Monitor. And we have links to her reporting at onpointradio.org. And both Laura and Sanam, in a few minutes, I want to get down to sort of the diplomatic options here. But first, let's just drill down a little bit more into one of the major current flashpoints, and that is shipping in the Strait of Hormuz, because as people might remember, on Friday, Iranian commandos seized a British tanker in the Straits. And Dryad Global, the shipping consultancy, released audio recordings of the moments just before Iranian commandos seized that tanker. And in this clip, you'll first hear a member of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard speaking to the tanker's crew and then a British naval officer warning the Iranian forces.
You obey, you will be safe. If you obey, you will be safe. Alter your course 260 degrees immediately. Over.
You must not impede, obstruct, or hamper the passage of the MV Stena Imperio.
That's audio from moments before Iranian commandos seized a British tanker in the Straits of Hormuz on Friday. Now, interestingly, just yesterday, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Zarif said in a message directed to the new incoming Prime Minister Boris Johnson, he said it's very important for Johnson as he enters number 10 Downing Street to understand that Iran does not seek confrontation, that Iran wants normal relations based on mutual respect. That's what the Iranian foreign minister said just yesterday. On the same day, Britain's foreign minister stood up in Parliament and announced that the European Union would begin protecting shipping in the Straits of Hormuz. Foreign minister spoke softly, but here was his message. He said, when it comes to Iran, The EU and the US might be going in different directions.
We will now seek to put together a European-led maritime protection mission to support safe passage of both crew and cargo in this vital region. It will not be part of the US maximum pressure policy on Iran, because we remain committed to preserving the Iran nuclear agreement.
That's the British Foreign Minister Hunt there just yesterday. So, Sanam, help us understand here about this flashpoint in the Straits of Hormuz. What is the current situation? And, for example, what is it that the UK wants out of this?
The UK position is very much complicated by a few issues. First of all, Brexit, where the UK has voted to leave the European Union. This is now going to be accelerated by the arrival of Boris Johnson as our new Prime Minister tomorrow. And the British have been signatories to the Iran nuclear agreement as well, and very much believe in defending that agreement, very frustrated along with their French and German counterparts regarding the Trump administration's unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear agreement. This has created a rift between the transatlantic allies. This rift has not been repaired, and Europe is very frustrated with Washington because they are left holding the responsibility to save the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement. Mm-hmm. And they very much blame the Trump administration for the escalating tensions in the Gulf that we have been witnessing over the past few months, whether it's the tanker attacks, the drone, militia groups that have been more adventurous in Yemen or in Iraq. So there's a lot of frustration here. And 2 weeks ago, the British government seized an Iranian tanker called the Grace One that was traveling to Syria. And they seized that tanker on the grounds that it was violating European sanctions, delivering oil to the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. That tanker was they did try to negotiate the release of that tanker unsuccessfully, and the Iranian government responded in kind by seizing a British tanker. And this has, of course, accelerated tensions specifically between the UK and Tehran. And interestingly here, the British actually took a very, I think, smart and independent strategy, because they don't want to be seen as being too aligned to Washington to jeopardize their efforts to save the Iranian nuclear agreement. And so rather than joining the U.S. maritime security initiative, they're creating their own with Europe. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of irony here, because at the same time, the U.K. is leaving the European Union.
Right.
So this is a very long-winded response to this very complicated situation.
Oh, no, please don't apologize, because it's the complexity that we're trying to understand right now. So I appreciate you guiding us through this. Laura, what's your response to that? It does seem as if, I mean, perhaps Britain is a unique case for all the reasons that Sanam was talking about, that, trying to leave the European Union perhaps will rely even more on its relationship with Washington in the future, whereas right now, as she pointed out, it's trying to also follow this European-led maritime protection mission in the Straits of Hormuz. It just makes me wonder about how much we can hope for the meeting that should be coming up in a couple of days between Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia, and Iran. Is there any hope for some sort of progress coming up through those diplomatic efforts in the coming days?
Yeah, well, it is so striking that Britain, which is probably the most U.S.-leaning of the five remaining international countries in the nuclear deal, and that has had its vessels seized now by Iran, that it still is leaning away from the U.S. initiative, which isn't to go to war with Iran. Ostensibly, it's to protect, maritime security. So it was striking that, even under those circumstances, Britain was still leaning away from Washington on that. For the upcoming Joint Commission meeting, you know, it's a sign of how complicated things are, that even getting the date was a negotiation, I understand, from the Europeans, that the Iranians wanted this meeting to happen at the ministerial level because they have a lot of grievances about promises they say have not been delivered to them by the remaining parties in terms of sanctions relief that they have not gotten. This meeting is not happening at that level. It's happening a couple rungs down at what's called the political director's level. And there was lots of, you know, of negotiations about the date that it would be held. It's unusual that it will be held on a Sunday, but they all finally agreed to come. What also came out last week from the outgoing EU foreign policy chief is that none of the remaining parties in the deal are yet ready to basically call out Iran as being in significant violation of the nuclear deal for the ratcheting down of voluntary compliance, they say, with some aspects of the deal to protest lack of sanctions relief they've been getting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're all still trying to buy time to see if they can get Iran to go back into compliance and seeming to understand Iran's actions as being in response to the U.S. maximum pressure campaign.
Okay, well, that's interesting. So on that point, let's go to a caller quickly here. Zane is calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Zane, you're on the air.
Thank you, Meghna. Hi to everyone. I think the maximum pressure policy by President Trump is absolutely the right policy toward Iran. European allies, they did the same game with the dictatorship of Saddam before during the 80s and the 90s, trying to secure their own economic oil gain from not really caring about the security of the region or human rights inside that country. They do the same thing now with Iran, trying to salvage a not really good deal with Iran yet. They are trying now to protect their own interests, protect their own ships. And that's what the President Trump called, to stand up and do their own part of their responsibilities, not necessarily just put the United States in the front and trying to take as much as possible economic financial gain out of Iran.
Yeah. So, Zane, thank you so much for your call. Laura Rosen, let me turn back to you on that. So, Zane, there, his line was a little shaky, but what he was trying to say was that he believes he sees Europeans as making the same mistake with Iran as the mm-hmm. international community did with Iraq, and that Iran, he's saying Europe only cares about the oil and those shipping lanes and not necessarily the stability of the region.
Well, I think the Iraq experience very much informs European misgivings about where Trump is going with the maximum pressure campaign. I know there are, especially in the United States, an Iranian diaspora, some who would love to see regime change in Iran, and they would like the U.S. to help advance that. I think the Europeans don't want any part of that. And my understanding is that Trump, through Japanese Prime Minister Abe, when he visited Iran a month ago, said that he was not pursuing regime change in Iran. So I'm afraid the Iranians in the diaspora are going to be disappointed either way, those who don't want a conflict with Iran and those who are disappointed if there are eventually more Trump engagement with Iran to get another deal.
Well, Sanam, what's your response to Zane, who questions European motivation sort of at their core?
I think that Laura is spot on. European policymakers are very much still suffering, at least at the domestic level, from the consequences of the 2003 Iraq War. They're being very cautious because they don't want to see a replay of Iraq with next-door Iran, which, from their calculation, is going to be a much more complicated war should it ever come to fruition, and a war that would probably very much impact Europe's security in terms of refugee flows, drug flows, and the like. So they have a very different calculation. Europe also has a longer history of engagement, as well as pressuring the Islamic Republic, whereas Washington actually has no history over the past 40 years of successful diplomacy beyond the nuclear agreement with Iran. So I think, I would sort of push back to your caller's question and question what are President Trump's objectives, and is this president actually going to be able to facilitate new negotiations with Tehran after, you know, basically unraveling the one successful diplomatic achievement between Washington and Tehran in a 40-year period.
Interesting. Okay, so let's go to one more call here. Edith is calling from Canton, Connecticut. Edith, you're on the air.
Yes, our president left the nuclear agreement. Now he's trying very hard to run the show, if you will, for our allies who are stuck without this country part of the agreement. I find that it's very interesting that he will find a way to get back in the picture of showing alliance. And I think it's just been a big, big mistake to have left. And it's beginning to show some results.
Yeah. Well, Edith, thank you for your call. Now, Laura Rosen, a couple of minutes ago, you were talking about shuttle diplomacy and diplomatic efforts here. It does seem as if there are some efforts, I don't know if I can necessarily say overtly coming from Washington or the Trump administration, but Politico has reported that Republican Senator Rand Paul met with Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, recently in an attempt to begin a dialogue between the United States and Iran. So here's Senator Paul on Fox News on Thursday before he met with the Iranian foreign minister.
I think diplomacy is a good idea, and I think that if sanctions are to work, you also have to talk about removing them. So I think the discussion now, since we have maximum pressure on and maximum sanctions on Iran, now we have to say, what would we be willing to remove them for? What type of behavior would we be willing to remove them for? I think there is a possible opening that Iran would sign an agreement saying that they won't develop a nuclear weapon, ever. That would be a huge breakthrough. I think President Trump is one of the few people who actually could get that deal.
Senator Rand Paul on Fox News on Thursday. Laura, what do you make of that? Is there some sort of quiet diplomacy going on between Washington and Tehran?
Yeah, I mean, that was really very interesting. I actually reported that meeting. Politico reported that Paul had asked Trump if he could be his envoy, meet with the Iranians, and reported that Trump had given him his permission. I think that leaked because a lot of the hawks around Trump are not happy about it. They do not consider Rand Paul where they are and where they want Trump to be. National Security Advisor John Bolton has been very skeptical of negotiations. So Trump, very interestingly, picked someone not in the administration to feel out the Iranians, to begin to see what they might need to get to the table with Trump. I do not have a readout of that meeting. I also know that Iranian President Rouhani has sent one of the top nuclear negotiators, Iraqchi, to France, I think today, to send a letter to Macron. Ostensibly, he's been doing some back-channeling between Washington and Iran, maybe to see what would be needed, Iran would need to try to cool temperatures down in the Gulf.
And so, I mean, does this mean that we should take stock in what Senator Paul says, that he thinks that there's a possibility that Iran would sign an agreement, quote, in his words, saying they won't develop a nuclear weapon ever?
I mean, some of the stuff that Rand Paul was talking about were already in the Iran nuclear deal,
right,
which I know is very frustrating for people who supported the deal, that Trump, you know, and some of the people around him don't seem to know what was in it or are so ideologically opposed to it that they would reinvent, you know, something that was just a small part of the deal. In any case, if Rand Paul is looking for a way that Trump can seize victory that Iran is willing to agree to, I think, you know, I would support that, for the sake of security.
Okay, well, Sanam Vakil, we've just got a couple of seconds left here, but given what Laura said, I mean, what do you think may come from the talks this weekend that won't include the United States?
The talks this weekend are about trying to freeze the current tensions, with the Iranians really trying to impress upon the French and the remaining signatories that they do actually need some tangible benefits. Not necessarily to go back into full nuclear compliance, but to dial down tensions. And this is important for Iran's domestic politics. It's important for President Rouhani and Zarif, who are kind of being silenced, and hardliners inside the country are pursuing their own maximum pressure campaign.
Well, Sanam Vakil, head of the Future Dynamics in the Gulf Project and the Iran Format at Chatham House in London, thank you. And Laura Rosen, diplomatic correspondent at Al Monitor, thank you. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.